Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
During the long hot summer, I broke a hole in the wall of the coal shed and put in a window. A floor and ceiling of timber beams, a door from planks of pine. And when the walls were painted peach white and the timbers warmed with Oregon rosewood stain, everyone agreed that the coal shed no longer existed. In its stead was a strange empty space, clean and cool, and because of the absence of electricity and the predominance of timber, somehow medieval. August. The high pressure continued. Not a breath of air. I would steal into the empty room in the dead heat of the afternoon, its window facing north, just to sit on the bare floor, be still and silent and cool. I could listen to the bees in the garden outside and dream about the south of France, the convent of St. Clair at Milau, and a special person who lives there. Some people come into our lives like guardians from other worlds. It is as if they were sent to watch over us, to give us some indefinable sustenance on our journey. The sort of person you never get to know well, you never get close to. You only meet occasionally every few years, and yet their presence seems enduring, continuous, significant, in the deepest recesses of the heart. Sandrine was such a person. I met her in a pub in Dunleary. She had arrived from Paris. It was the mid-70s. She modelled in the College of Art and lived in a small flat with two Irish friends. She learned English from them, and soon the three were inseparable. Their humour, their laughter, their kindness flowed as one stream. The men who surrounded them often craved for things, money or drugs or sex. But being in the women's company was like a healing process. It was as if all the craving had been suspended for a few moments, as if everything had ceased except their laughter. And I always felt Sandrine to be the heart of this odd and wonderful nexus. I remember the big woolly jumpers, the incense sticks, the candlelight, the soft French vowels. Then suddenly she left. The friends drifted apart. The centre was gone. By chance, 4 years later, I was walking round the Pompidou Centre in Paris, and I came out into the square, and there she was, distributing anti-nuclear leaflets. We spent a few days together, visited Notre Dame, had a meal one evening in a Turkish restaurant, but mostly hung out for hours on the street with the anti-nuclear leaflets and a tin whistle. When she put her arms round me at the station to bid farewell, I felt the strength of her body through the wool jumper, and I sensed how tightly we both might have clung to each other in another life. The intensity of it left me dizzy all the way to London. And that was the end of it, until yet another 4 years later. I had reached that stage in life's journey known as the mess. Put another way, my entire life had fallen apart, and I was packing the broken remnants in boxes for storage, when through the door came a letter. Little notebook-sized pages, saffron in colour, written in Biro. She said that she had entered a contemplative convent in the south of France, and that in its enclosed space, in its silence, in its strict old-world regime, she had found peace. I was amazed. I folded the little pages neatly back into the envelope and forgot about them for almost 12 years. Converting the coal shed was a significant act. It was a sign that I had finally put my life back together again. I opened the cardboard boxes, closed for over a decade, and the first thing that fell onto the floor was the envelope with the little notebook-sized pages, saffron in colour. And I marvelled once again at every line, every phrase, every blessing. Que Marie te comble de sa tendresse. I sat on the floor and spent the remains of August in the shade, in the quiet cool of that empty room, thinking about the south of France.
When I was a young blade, not so many years ago, knocking around Queen's University in Belfast, I used to have a reputation for being something of a night owl, one of those people who start to come alive when everything else is going to sleep. Let there be a late night party, or a hoolie, or a drinking session, or a game of poker, and I'd be in there with the best of them, singing song for song, downing drink for drink. If not actually the first to arrive, certainly the last to go home. In those days, I used to regard it as a sinful waste of God's good time to be lying in bed asleep when there was so much enjoyment to be wrung from life. Bed was somewhere to go when the party was over and the last poker pot scraped from the middle. Now, in those days in Belfast, there used to be ample scope for that kind of behaviour, for although the public houses used to disgorge their contents at the unearthly hour of 10 p.m, there were other places you could go. And provided you played your cards right, there was no reason why you couldn't sit with good company, knocking back bottles of Red Heart Stout until the dawn broke over Divis Mountain. These places were referred to disparagingly, mainly by people who couldn't get into them, as shebeens. And since the vast majority of them had no license to sell drink in the first place, they didn't see any good reason to be scrupulous about the licensing hours. And a great boon they were to people like myself, who got more pleasure from drinking at 3 o'clock in the morning than 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The shebeens have all gone now, as far as I know, or at least they've got themselves licences and have become respectable, so that they too follow the fashion now and throw their patrons out at closing time. So I don't know what the people in Belfast do now about the late night drink, although I'm sure they manage. The other great late night attraction when I was a young lad, was the party, and these used to be held all over the place, particularly at weekends. All that was required was a six-pack carry-out when the pubs were closing, and a bottle of Frank McAlevey's jungle juice that he used to make in the bath of his house round in Palestine Street, and you'd enough to keep a body going till the milkman arrived in time for breakfast. Nowadays, I have to admit that advancing age and increasing family commitments have put something of a halt to my gallop in the line of late-night activity. For one thing, it is becoming increasingly clear to me that the occupation of night owl is severely restricted to that category of individual who is classified by the revenue commissioners as single. Or if he or she is married, the condition necessarily requires that the union be not blessed with issue. The reason I say that should be immediately clear to anyone who has ever been wakened from their slumber at 7 a.m. after a night on the tiles by an avalanche of energetic children bouncing on the bed and telling anyone who will listen that Mammy has burnt the toast again. A few mornings of that sort of thing soon has even the most hardened night owl glancing at his watch at parties and developing a healthy respect for the good night's sleep. Occasionally, I still suffer the odd regressional tendency towards my youthful nocturnal preoccupations, but this tends only to happen when I'm away on a junket with other members of the Fourth Estate, with my wife and children in no danger of wakening me up in the morning. And anyway, given the present recession, this sort of educational venture is rapidly becoming a vague memory that older journalists reminisce about over a few pints in Mulligan's pub.
It arrived 1 year to the day after her death, hauled in by two removal men who set it down as carefully as they could and asked, a little fearfully, if I wanted it upstairs. I had asked her for it. She had left it to me, and I wanted to have it near. The lid of it makes a tabletop. When I raised it up, the smell of metal, oil, leather, wood and thread brought it back. This was the scent of long ago, afternoons in the family room spent in failing light, me at my lessons and her sitting up at the window at work on the sewing machine. The sound the sheets made when she pulled them open with her hands was sharper than the hum of the treadle and the whir of the wheel. It would break the quiet rhythms of the room, the fire and its shadows on the brasses, the spruce trees etched in darkness on the glass, the dog whining gently to come in. It could be more than 20 years ago, or it could be now, here in the new home I have made. With one push of the treadle, one turn of the wheel, the needle rises and drops as it always has. It is another winter afternoon. I sit at the singer in failing light, and I have laid in yards of cotton to make curtains for the room where my children, not yet born, will one day sleep. I am no seamstress, though I learned at school, made nylon aprons and a toweling teddy for the missions with the other girls. I could have bought the curtains ready-made, but something of those afternoons, their ceremony and lull, is not lost on me. Perhaps it is the feeling, unacknowledged, that I can make those moments hum again, and somehow that by doing what she did, I'll revive the steady rhythm of her life. Hers was the last hand to touch this sewing machine. I know she has threaded it for me. Gone into the family room, now cold and packed with boxes, past a hollow grate, the chair where I would sit over my books, my knees drawn up. She has gone into this room where she so rarely goes. She has sat at this machine in failing light and remembered with her hands and a white card held behind how to wind the thread from reel to bobbin to needle to eye to reel. She knew I would not know how, and the sewing machine would be finally undone. So now, 1 year after her death, it stands in my house, primed for use, not with the white thread she so often used, but with black she knew would suit most of my clothes. There's a drawer to the front, shallow and neat. Inside, I found an array of buttons from 20 years of family clothes. I could have told her life from them. Buttons from best dresses, slacks for every day, small pearls from my father's shirts, a spare from the winter coat she loved, two peach ones from her dress from my sister's wedding, the summer blouses, the widow's black. I laid them out, the colours and shapes of them so lively, so bereft. These days my son and daughter play with them. One day they are medals, the next day coins. I tell them about her as they spin and barter the bright discs, her life, her stories, the patterns that she stitched in all our lives.
Thank you. Once upon a time, I was an evil dwarf. The evil dwarf, to be more precise. And of course, I only played the part. But even so, to be good at it, you had to unearth everything in yourself that was evil and dwarfish and drag it up into the limelight. I was then working as an actor at a small city theatre in North Germany, in Cuxhaven, at the mouth of the river Elbe. And that year's Christmas pantomime was Snow White and Rose Red, one of the Grimm fairy tales. Grimm, indeed, because it contained this evil dwarf, hoarder of a large treasure deep in the forest, after having turned the beautiful prince into an ugly bear. But of course, he gets his comeuppance in the end. I must have been a convincing blackguard, for night after night the children just hated me, heckling continuously and screaming with delight at the dwarf's climactic trouncing by the big bear. I was helped by a most inspired costume, dark spindly legs, a big hump covered by a coat made out of withered leaves, a long thinnish beard like cobwebs, coal-black eyes under a pale thatch of dried grass out of which grew a wickedly crooked red root, a twilight creature rising out of the forest floor and melting back into it. But like every good ham worth his salt, I also saw him as a tragically misunderstood being. To no avail, I have to admit, the children wanted their villain pure and simple. Except on one occasion. We had travelled deep into the cultural wasteland of the North German plain and were to perform in a huge community hall, as inviting and stimulating as an airport hangar. Well over 1,000 children had been bused to the place for the big cultural event of the year, or maybe of all their childhood years. And they were a wonderfully attentive and lively audience, all the characters of the play, Bear, Woodcutter, the girls and the evil dwarf, all weaving their magic spell on them. The great moment for me came. Having done my evil worst, I jumped up and down with glee, rubbing my black-nailed claws, hump bumping, the withered red root on my head twitching, and proclaimed triumphantly, "To be evil is fun!" 1,000 voices screamed back at me, "No!" "Oh, yes, it is!" and "No!" again. It was like standing in the noise of 100 jet engines. The air was thick with disapproval. The evil dwarf, of course, was in his element. Wallowing in it, he worked the crowd of little innocents for what it was worth. And then, the totally unexpected, the absolutely unexpectable happened. In the middle of all that turmoil, the jumping and screaming, a tiny little girl in the front row stood up, a blonde, blue-eyed little snowflake, and shyly, but also like somebody who deep inside knew exactly what she was doing, walked up to the ramp, so terribly close to the dreadful dwarf, raised her arm, and offered me a sweet. To a howl of protest from 1,000 other kids, and went back to her seat. Now, how to react to that? Well, I tell you, I felt totally deflated, but also, as an actor, deeply understood and appreciated. The frozen heart had to melt for a moment. I thanked her awkwardly, ate my sweet, and for the rest of the evening had to work hard to regain my evil reputation. The show had to go on. Since then, I've often wondered what had gone on in the mind of that little girl, and what may have become of her in her later years. A child that at the age of 4 or 5 had risked her life to bring solace to another being who was unhappy and evil.
Thank you. When I was 12, I was put into care. Not out of poverty, you understand, or because I lacked parents. I hadn't even been bowled. No, the institution where I spent 5 unrepeatable years of my life was a boarding school for girls on the edge of a cliff in Scotland. It was a place where parents, for a handsome fee, could be guaranteed that their daughters, while benefiting from the bracing effects of Arctic gales, would be cultivated like exotic flowers, sheltered from the damaging drafts of life. Or so they were led to believe as they signed the cheques. It was only much later, when finally I could bring myself to look back, that the penny dropped. Far from being a hothouse flower, I, along with several hundred other nice girls, had been used as a human guinea pig. Yet this was no educational project, oh no. It suddenly became clear as day that we all had been part of a highly sophisticated Darwinian experiment. Only the fittest survived. The experiment had obviously been set up with full scientific rigour, the aim being to measure what extremes of sensory deprivation and suppression of individual expression subjects could undergo and still retain a spark of life. They certainly knew how to run boarding schools in those days. Nothing was left to chance. Our days progressed to the sound of bells from 10 to 7 in the morning until 9:30 at night. No items of personal clothing were tolerated. Hair was to be worn off the collar, long hair to be tied back, but not with ribbons. School hats were to be worn at all times when walking in the town. Strapped shoes were for indoor wear only. School bags were to be carried in the right hand. Girls were to walk along the left-hand side of corridors. All commercial streets in the town were out of bounds. Girls seen entering shops were punished. Some of us put up more of a fight than others. My friend Jane was a true rebel and a constant trial to our keepers. One February tea time, as she contemplated her poached fish with customary enthusiasm, a worm raised its torso to her in salute. Her chair crashed to the lino as she got up to protest, but her complaints fell on deaf ears. Worse, she was told to stop looking for trouble. There was no worm, and it was not alive. With insult added to injury, Jane decided she must have justice. Clutching her plate, she stormed downstairs to the cloakroom, changed out of her strap shoes into her laced shoes, donned the uniform coat and hat, and set out into the night to walk the 30 miles that separated her from the supreme arbiter, the headmistress. On the way, she stopped under a street lamp to check the worm's state of health. A kindred spirit, a survivor too. Alas, it had given up its struggle. The corpse lay lifeless in a shroud of white sauce. Jane's mission had aborted. She dumped the fish in the gutter for a passing cat, and heart heavy, turned back. A battle had been lost, but our struggle for survival went on.
Mary Russell, who died recently in her 89th year, was a rare bird, a travel writer with insatiable curiosity about the wider world, particularly the Middle East. A petite woman with a shock of dyed red hair, she had a cheerfully inquisitive way of looking at people and places. "There's only one way to travel," she declared. "Travel with a companion and you come complete with an invisible wall around you. When there's two of you, there's no chance of the magical invitation to coffee that opens the door through which every travel writer needs to go. You need to be able to peep along the corridor and see the bed unmade at 3 p.m, she insisted, to take in the other little touches that reveal so much about the lives you have come to chronicle. And into her little notebook, those insights, literally insights, discreetly went. She didn't write guidebooks, but rather made maps of understanding the communities she visited. She wasn't lonely travelling alone. Each night she relished the task of transcribing and trying to make sense of the day's challenges and experiences. She had homes in Dublin and Oxford, considering wherever she was to be home. Dublin was a bit livelier, she admitted, and she added to the decibels by playing the saxophone in her spare time in an ensemble of contemporaries called Blow the Dust. Mary Russell was not one who wrote much about herself. The big wide world was too fascinating for that. Yet there's a phrase in her self-penned CV that hints at an inner sadness. I was 9 when I was sent away to boarding school, and it was there I learned the true meaning of loneliness, she wrote. I missed my mother singing as she dried the dishes, the sound of my father rattling the pages of the Irish Times, the smell of toast in the kitchen. However, the boarding school, the Bower in Athlone, was where she fell in love with words, and also with the chaplain, but that didn't last. After school, she enjoyed university life, the men, the sophisticated Dublin girls, and the beginning of sex, as she put it. London afterwards was even more exciting, parties and bedsitters in Earl's Court. In 1960, she met and married a writer called Ian Roger, and they had 3 children, 2 daughters and a son. Ian died of motor neuron disease in 1984. That wasn't in the plan, she said. Afterwards, I found myself doing the things he used to do, obsessively watching the post for a letter from a publisher, on my knees sorting through bills and receipts to send to my accountant. Without realising it, she was taking up where Ian had left off, so perhaps there was a plan after all. Ian's final illness overlapped with Mary waking from the long dream of domesticity, as she put it. Their children were becoming adults. She plunged into an MA course at the School of Peace Studies at Bradford University and started writing regularly for The Guardian. The following year she travelled to Lesotho, the first of many such journeys. This became the genesis of her book, The Blessings of a Good Thick Skirt. Other books would follow, her curiosity about out-of-the-way people and places being the magnet. I'm good at getting into conversation with people. I'm inquisitive and nosy. She could have added warm and friendly. Subjects which she shared with listeners to Sunday Miscellany included the Sahara Desert, where she went to learn about the displaced Sahrawi people, and the Arctic, where she went to investigate the reindeer herders of northern Finland. She visited the island of Dominica to learn about the Caribs, who were the original inhabitants of the Caribbean. When walking on rough ground, one should cut a good stout stick for support, she advised listeners to this programme, though one could also be found in the bottom of a ditch, she added. Her account contrasting the canals of Dublin and Oxford in the 1980s can be heard shortly. Mary Russell was at her home in Oxford in 2020 when the COVID pandemic struck. A bad fall restricted her mobility and her friends in Dublin would not see her again. As her end approached, she became infuriated when her memory failed to provide the exact words she needed. That apart, she remained the same curious, friendly live wire she had made herself. Thank you.
One of the shortest but most pleasant journeys I made this autumn began at a pub a few miles from the centre of Oxford. I'd driven there to meet a friend, but having arrived, I was able to ditch the car and travel by her preferred means of transport, a canoe. Not the sort where half your body has to be buttoned down into one of those orange coveralls, and in which you're supposed to be able to keep going and come up the other side still holding your breath, should you be unlucky enough to capsize. No, the sort we got into was a Canadian canoe, a large, elegant, polished wood affair with a curved prow, roomy enough to let me jump out at the slightest sign of turbulence. We fixed a candle near the prow. Apparently, it's only fair to warn people that you're coming, and off we went, me paddling up front and my companion steering from behind. Oxford is best known for its rivers, the Isis, the Cherwell and the Thames, but we, in fact, were on the canal, a waterway which runs a course both straight and true, so that all we had to avoid was the occasional submerged tree or overhanging willow. We'd no need for the candle, it turned out, since the moon was bright and clear, turning to a glistening silver the still waters which we had to navigate. We moved forward smoothly and silently, for I'd found a way of slipping the paddle into the water without causing too much disturbance to the surface. Occasionally, on the towpath side, we passed a houseboat, and for a second the way ahead would glow yellow as the light of an oil lamp shone across our path. Then, too, we might catch a glint of metal in the hedge where the owner's bicycle had been thrown. For these houseboats are not quaint tourist attractions, but much sought-after dwellings. Sometimes, up on the roof, two small green eyes would tell us that a cat was keeping guard over its quiet domain. An old Oxford resident told me once that long ago the canal was so quiet that when he was fishing, it was nothing for a kingfisher to land on the end of his rod and stay there. By day, there are plenty of fishermen on the banks, the unsporting sort, whose long rods reach right across the canal, intruding into the waters below the overhanging bank, where previously the fish had thought to lie low. Early in the morning, you can often see a flight of duck whirring swiftly down the canal, heading straight for the railway station, their uniform plumage and neat formation making them look uncannily like a row of commuting businessmen dashing for the 7:10 for Paddington. Being rural, the Oxford Canal has a bustling wildlife activity, which is in contrast to the small stretch of Dublin's Grand Canal, which I've got to know. Here, the inhabitants of the canal must live their lives in full view of human passers-by, their natural right to peace constantly interrupted by car horns and wailing sirens. Nevertheless, they all go about their business with dignity, the duck tending to their young, the cob guarding his mate, and both of them graciously deigning to accept the bits of bread thrown to them by faithful admirers. Sometimes the canal acts as a sort of corridor for a blustery wind, which I like to imagine is coming due west, straight from the Atlantic, but which wiser friends tell me is merely fanciful thinking on my part. Perhaps it's the gulls wheeling over the locks which give me this idea, though they, of course, have come from a different direction. But it's by night that this city canal comes into its own. The frothy surge in the locks seems more powerful when heard rather than seen. When daylight is gone, the dark waters become private again, and though the restless lights of cars and buses move incessantly across the surface, the navy blue pools of water, peopled by shadowy reeds, offer fish a haven of relative safety where they can lie undisturbed by the long rods of the greedy angler.
On this morning's Sunday Miscellany, which featured a number of recordings from the programme archive of the 1980s and 1990s, we heard A Guardian from Another World by Michael Harding. Nighthawks was by Eugene McIldowney. The Singer Sewing Machine was by Vona Gwork. Not a Fairy Tale by the late Peter Yankovsky. Survival by Geraldine Mitchell. Travelling Light in Strange Places, Remembering Mary Russell was by Kieran Fagan. And Contrasting the Canals of Dublin and Oxford by the late Mary Russell. And the music, Salve Regina, performed by the Benedictines of Mary, Queen of Apostles. Midnight Summer Dream by the Stranglers. Songs My Mother Taught Me by Dvorak, performed by Yo-Yo Ma and Patricia Zander. Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy by Tchaikovsky was performed by the Orchestre Symphonique de Montreal, conducted by Charles Dutoit. Miri It Is, sung by the Oxford Girls Choir. And Dancing in the Loft by John Surman and Howard Moody. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to the programme if you like on the RTE radio app, on the programme website or on any of the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.